نحمده ونصلي ونسلم على رسوله الكريم أما بعد قال الله تعالى في القرآن المجيد بعد أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ولا تقولوا لمن يقتل في سبيل الله أموات صدق الله العلي العظيم وصدق رسوله النبي الكريم ونحن على ذلك لمن الشاهدين والشاكرين والحمد لله رب العالمين My respected brothers and elders in Islam, it is exactly 1 week ago that we learned of the mass murder of Musallin who gathered in a masjid like we do and where 50 people became shuhada, who lost their lives and were martyred. This happened, as you all know, in New Zealand. Now, New Zealand has a relatively very small population. New Zealand has about 4.8 million people, the size of Johannesburg itself. So the entire country has a population similar to the size of Johannesburg, very sparsely populated country. And Muslims constitute 1% of the total population, so around 50,000 Muslimin in the entire New Zealand. These shootings took place in a city called Christchurch, which is the third largest city in New Zealand. And as you know, a 28-year-old white extremist or terrorist opened fire when people got together to discharge the Jummah Salah or perform the Jummah Salah exactly a week ago. This entire incident has brought several issues to the fore. And one of which is that religion is responsible for the mayhem, for the massacre, and for global wars. In other words, if you take away religion, there'll be peace in the world. And therefore, there are many people who have now become agnostics. People who believe in the existence of a God but do not believe in religion. Because they say religion divides us, religion is contributing to the kind of mayhem and the wars that we see around the globe. And therefore, we will believe in a God but we would not believe in a religion. But history and the facts show otherwise. There's a research done, which is called the Encyclopedia of Wars. And this research was conducted by two non-Muslims. They found that, and they went back and looked at the wars that were documented throughout the history of man. And they found that there were 1,763 wars that took place. 1,763 wars that took place. From the 1,763 wars, 123 wars had a religious angle or a religious cause to it. In other words, 7% of all the wars that took place had some kind of religious motivation behind it. 93% of all the wars globally had nothing to do with religion. And of all the people that died in these wars, 2% of those of them died because of a kind of religious conflict. 98% died or lost their lives because of reasons other than religion. So this misnomer that religion is responsible for division and is contributing to warfare and contributing to global instability is a myth. When it comes to Islam itself, some people, and the media in particular, project Islam to be inherently violent. But if you look at history again, Muslims had no hand in the First World War. Muslims had no hand in the Second World War. Muslims had no hand in dropping the bombs on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Muslims had no hand in the fact that 180,000 people were captured and enslaved from the shores of Africa and taken across. Those that had died were simply tossed into the Atlantic Ocean. So, one of the issues that came to the fore is the role of religion in global conflict. And the facts clearly state that religion per se has a very minimal role in contributing to global instability and the warfare that we see around us. The second issue was actually an issue brought about by Muslims who asked a difficult question, that people assembled in the house of Allah to perform the most important prayer of the week, that is Salatul Jummah. Salah and our subservience to Allah ought to protect us. How is it that people who came to show their subservience to Allah, who assembled to discharge the most important prayer of the week, were butchered in this manner? Where was the protection? Is this some? How do you reconcile the fact that prayer ought to guard you, safeguard you, and the fact that so many people were massacred when they assembled to pray? And the answer to that is not very difficult. That is, your iman and your faith is not an insurance against catastrophe, hardship, or difficulty. In fact, the opposite is true. The sunnah of all the anbiya alayhimus salatu wassalam was struggle. They had to do battle with their own people. They had to go into exile. So struggle is part of the DNA of a Muslim. Declaring our faith in Allah is not an insurance or a protection against hardship or calamity. And we can understand that if we understand the purpose of our lives on this earth. Allah says that we've created life, death and life, لِيَبْلُوَكُمْ أَيُّكُمْ أَحْسَنُ عَمَلًا, to see, to test which of you are the best indeed. So life is a test. How you're going to respond to it will determine whether you pass your test or fail. But having faith is not going to protect you from death. Allah says, كُلُّ نَفْسٍ ذَائِكَةُ الْمَوْتِ. Every person is going to taste death. Some are going to die a natural death. Some are going to die because of a sickness. Some are going to die at the hands of oppressors and tyrants. But death is inevitable. But the verse follows and says, فَمَنْ زُحْزِهَ عَنِ النَّارِ, that those that are saved and protected from the fire, وَأُدْخِلَ الْجَنَّةِ, and are admitted into paradise, pursuant to death, فَقَدْ فَازْ, they have achieved the supreme success. What have these 50 people achieved? They've achieved martyrdom. Martyrs, Allah says in the verse that I recited before you, لَا تَقُولُوا لِمَنْ يُقْتَلُ, that do not brand those that are who die in the path of Allah as dead. Martyrs do not die. Martyrs simply cease to exist. They're not dead. Allah says, Allah sustains them in their graves. وَلَكِنْ لَا تَشْعُرُونَ, but you as humans would not perceive the life of a martyr in the grave. So those who lost their lives, the 50 odd people who lost their lives, lost their earthly existence, but were crowned with the highest honor, and that is martyrdom. Abu Huraira radiallahu ta'ala anhu narrates a hadith that a martyr does not feel the impact of pain more than the sting of a mosquito. That's the only irritation that a martyr feels. He is protected by Allah. From our eyes, we see the anguish. We see the pain. But the experience of a martyr is very different. He feels no pain. And in another hadith narrated by by Miqdad radiallahu ta'ala anhu, he says, a martyr is forgiven before his blood spurts onto the ground. A martyr, all his sins are forgiven before the blood touches the ground. And before the ruh leaves his body, he is shown his place in Jannah. What greater honor could be for those that have lost their lives in the massacre? The third thing that comes to the fore is the emergence of right-wing extremism, white supremacist or racists who have been on the surface of this globe from the time of the Ku Klux Klans. But white supremacism gained traction for four reasons. One is post 9/11, where this picture was of Muslims who are blood hungry was actually beamed throughout the world. Two, white supremacism gained this traction because of immigration, foreigners coming into the land. Thirdly, because they felt they had a superior culture and these foreigners are diluting their culture. And fourthly, now they had to compete for scarce resources. And this gave rise to the kind of white extremism that we see, not among individuals only, but entire governments, if you look globally, entire governments have shifted to the right. The United States of America has shifted to the right. The very person who shot 50 people said, I was inspired by Trump's racist hope for white supremacy. So if you look at the United States, it's moved to the right. If you look at Russia, it's moved to the right. China, India, Israel has been always to the extreme right. You look at Brazil, has moved to the right. So many countries in Europe have moved to the right. So before 9/11, the value system that was surfacing and was espoused by governments was the human rights culture. After 9/11, we had the anti-terror legislation that kind of superimposed itself on human rights. And as a result, you see a shift towards the extreme right. But what does this mean for Muslims? Muslims who were immigrants, who settled in these countries, were now under surveillance. The extreme right was hardly under the radar. If you look at in Europe, in particular, the number of right-wing arrests are virtually insignificant when compared to Muslims who are arrested on the suspicion of Islamic extremism. Just on extremism, not violence. On the one hand, you have right-wing violence, and on the other, you have suspicion of extremism. So, most governments have not focused intelligence on the rise of the white right-wing extremism. Over and above that, this particular incident has brought to the fore media bias. A survey revealed that if a Muslim commits an act of violence, especially in Europe and America, there is 357 times more exposure in the media than if the same act is committed by a non-Muslim. 357 times more exposure if a Muslim is guilty of a particular violent act. If you look at how this entire incident was covered, the label terrorism is used exclusively for Muslims. This 28-year-old white extremist was labeled as a shooter, not a terrorist, as a shooter, almost sanitizing his crime. You know, a shot that gone wrong, that is how he was labeled. And the major newspapers introduced him as an angelic boy who grew up to become a mass wing murderer. Is this how a murderer ought to be introduced? That almost his whiteness gave him some kind of purity, some kind of innocence. And it was only later that he was angel at heart, and it was only later that he succumbed to influences from the outside. So this entire incident has brought to the fore how the media actually covers instances of violence based on the person's faith. Each time there is a murder or an act of terrorism, the Muslim world is called upon to apologize and to speak out against an act of terror. Yet we are hardly to see one single call for Christianity or for Christians to actually come to the fore and apologize for what has happened in New Zealand. And lastly, what we've seen through this incident is an unprecedented support from non-Muslims, especially in New Zealand, led by the Prime Minister herself, in showing support to the Muslims. The fact that the Quran was for the first time ever recited in the Parliament of New Zealand. The fact that even gangsters came out and said, "We will protect the mosques when you pray." The fact that the entire cabinet found it necessary to be present to show the support to the Muslim community shows the kind of unprecedented exposure that Islam has enjoyed through this incident. Our challenge is to make use of this opportunity to engage with non-Muslims, to show them the true teachings of Islam, to show them the media bias, to show them how Muslims are profiled, and to show them what Islam stands for. If we lose this opportunity, we lose a window of opportunity that would not come back to us. Have we engaged and interacted with people of other faiths on this particular issue? Have we spoken to them about how religion has been used as a scapegoat to kind of entrench this white supremacist mentality? وآخر دعوانا الحمد لله رب العالمين.